Today's A Slice of Medieval. It is just myself, Sharon Bennett Connolly, and Derek Burks today. We've actually set ourselves quite a challenge because we decided we would look into a period of history that neither of us is over familiar with, which is the deposition of Richard II and the accession of Henry IV. So bear with us. This could be challenging. So Derek, I suppose the first thing we ought to do is look into who exactly were Richard II and Henry IV.
Well, okay, so let's assume everybody knows less than us, which is a very dangerous assumption. We're talking about the 14th century, the end of the 14th century. We're talking about Richard II and Henry IV, who were both grandsons of Edward III. And you might know enough about Edward III to know that he had a lot of children, so therefore he had even more grandchildren. Mm. Richard and Henry are cousins, first cousins. Richard is the son of Edward Black Prince. We've talked about the Black Prince a fair bit of late. He's the younger son of the Black Prince, the older one having died a little earlier. Henry is the son of Edward III's third son, John of Gaunt, Duke of Lancaster. The two cousins are the sons of probably the two most prominent sons of Edward III.
Yeah.
Those who played a significant role in politics and warfare of Edward III's reign. So obviously, because the Black Prince, who was Edward III's heir, his eldest son, because he died before Edward III, the throne went to the Black Prince's son, surviving son, who was Richard and became Richard II. That's the two people we're talking about, two cousins, one of whom succeeded to the throne, and the other who was the eldest son of John of Gaunt.
I thought it was quite interesting, though, when I looked at it, they actually have, on the face of it, they have a fair few things in common, Richard and Henry. They're very similar ages.
Yes.
They're about 3 months apart in age.
Yeah.
Neither was intended to become king. Neither was born to be king. Richard was the younger son. I mean, Richard lost his dad at the age of 9. Henry had lost his mum when he was a baby. He wasn't 2 years old. So you look at that and you think they could have been friends, or probably should have been friends. They had a lot in common and they were a similar age and they were first cousins. But they were totally different personalities.
Yeah, hugely different personalities. And both, in a way, while their fathers were alive, were very much in the shadow of two of the greatest sort of figures in the period. So I guess until, in each case, probably until their fathers died, they were lesser men in a sense. They certainly Richard was, and I think Henry was as well. Though his father lived an awful lot longer than the Black Prince did.
Yeah, I think because John of Gaunt certainly kept hold of the Duchy of Lancaster until his death. He did, when he went on expedition to Spain in 1386, I think it was, to try and win the throne of Castile.
Yeah.
He left Henry in charge of the Duchy of Lancaster,
yeah,
which must have been pretty decent training ground for him. But then when John goes back, he takes over the reins again.
Hmm.
And then Henry goes off gallivanting. He went on crusade in Lithuania or something.
That's right, yes, yeah, in sort of Eastern Europe or Northern Europe, yeah. I'm not quite sure what the crusade was all about, but I guess in a way, if you are the eldest son of a man who is still very prominent and influential, what else do you do, really?
I thought about it, though.
Yeah.
When I looked at it, I thought, well, Henry had all this freedom to go on crusade, he did a tour of the royal courts of Europe and was apparently very impressive. And it's like, Richard couldn't do that because from the age of 10, Richard was King of England.
Mm.
So he couldn't go off and find himself, go on a sort of grand tour like young men were supposed to do. you know, and just have a little freedom. It was, he went from being a child to being a king.
Yeah.
And restrained by kingship, even though it meant he had total authority, it was still a restraining institution.
Yeah, and of course he didn't have total authority whilst he was still a child. So there was that whole minority situation that he inherited, in a sense. He wasn't really fully expressing the powers of a king until much later than that. So Richard's legacy, in a sense, Richard's whole sort of image in history, is very much shaped by Shakespeare, like a number of other historical figures that we won't mention. And I think in this case, though, I mean, I think Shakespeare was not too far adrift in his play Richard II. I think, you know, it's probably one of the more historically accurate, as far as we can judge, plays, both in terms of the events, but also in terms of the nature of Richard and Henry.
Yeah.
Quite interesting from that point of view. Richard has had a bad press, hasn't he?
Yeah. I was reading an essay on Henry IV, I think it was, by Christopher Gibbon Wilson. And he says Henry's often overlooked, except by Shakespeare.
Yeah.
Because apparently Shakespeare did, there was a play on Richard II, one play on Henry V, and then there's two plays on Henry IV. So he seems to have been more sympathetic to Henry IV. And Christopher Gibbon Wilson says that it was Henry IV's reign that was the turning point. It was the fulcrum between the, well, between the 14th and 15th century, you know, and that was what shaped the 15th century, which I suppose so, especially given the actions of Henry and what it was the portent for, because as you and I both know, a lot of people look at the usurpation by Henry IV as the cause of the Wars of the Roses.
Yeah, this all, I mean, obviously it predates Shakespeare, and this is the thing that often annoys me about people saying, well, it's all Shakespeare's fault that the modern image of any particular medieval personage. Shakespeare used sources, and those sources were written for various reasons. And one of his main sources was Edward Hall, one of the chroniclers of the mid-Tudor period. Now, Hall was one of the first, possibly not the first, but one of the first to present the whole idea that the Tudors had reunited the houses of York and Lancaster. And it was Hall, amongst others, who suggested in the middle of the Tudor period that the problem goes back to the usurpation of Henry IV, that it was that moment in 1399 when Richard II was deposed. That's when the seeds of the Wars of the Roses were sown.
Mm.
I mean, it's how not just Hall, but many people in the Tudor period and many educated people would have regarded the immediate history of the country. It's not Hall saying something that was unusual. It's Hall reflecting what most people thought at the time.
Yeah,
it seemed like that. Mm. But with the perspective of hundreds of years later, I think it's fairly clear that that's just rubbish. You know, it wasn't the start of anything, really. It was more likely the end of something.
Yeah, you had another 50 years after the usurpation where things could have happened differently. Or, you know, if Henry VI hadn't had the mental illness, the Wars of the Roses may never have happened.
Yeah, I think if you take the view that any sort of diversion of the line of succession was going to cause problems 100 years later, that's a very odd view to take, because the English line of succession was diverted quite a number of times over the years. Didn't necessarily mean you were going to have something like the Wars of the Roses happen as a result of it. You know, I mean, stuff happens, basically.
But the main thing in the usurpation of 1399 is, I think, the characters of the two people involved. Now, Richard had been king for 22 years. And his reign had started on sort of on a promising note, even though he was only 10 when he became king. He was faced in the first years with challengers. England was still suffering from the effects of the Black Death. The population had been reduced by anywhere between 30 and 50%. When I was at school, it was always a third of the population.
Yeah.
And now they're saying 50% of half the population.
Yeah.
So
more have died since, obviously. I know exactly what I was taught.
Which is quite funny. After 700 years, more of them have now died. It's like, well, yes.
Yeah. By the time our grandchildren learn it, learning about it, there'll have been hardly anybody who survived the Black Death.
Oh God, we shouldn't laugh. This is the Black Death.
But I mean, yeah, you're right. I mean, the effects of the Black Death were still, well, not still being felt, more the longer term effects, the social effects, which were sort of feeding through. The immediate effects of people dying was obviously during Edward III's reign. And during the latter stages of Edward III's reign, you've got these other social effects bubbling up, the lack of labor, and therefore the laborer becomes much more important and starts to think about how, what he could demand, you know, in return for his labor, and so on and so forth. And the landowning fraternity, the nobility, and so on, they didn't particularly want to give those who labored on their estates any more than they had had before. So you have this kind of upsurge of opposition from the sort of peasant class, which we hadn't seen for quite a while. I mean, occasionally it does bubble up in the medieval period, but this was a very significant uprising in lots of different areas, I think produced by genuine anger and frustration.
Yeah, well, like you said, they had the peasants were being kept down and not paid their worth. The poll tax had been introduced, which was a tax on every single person in the country, rich or poor, and I think it was the same amount to pay for wars. And then they had another one
Yeah.
in 1379 and another one in 1380. And it was the 1381 that led to the unrest, because apparently one of the tax collectors in Dartford in Kent attacked Wat Tyler's daughter. Probably not the right thing to do, because Wat Tyler then kills the tax collector and starts this revolution. Basically, you know, he's trying to change things. And by the time they marched on London, there were 100,000 rebels.
Yeah. Well, it was all over the place in the south, wasn't it? South and southeast particularly, but elsewhere I think as well. The poll tax seemed particularly unfair to people who already felt they were being downtrodden and poorly treated. And of course, it was partly to pay for the Hundred Years' War, because the Hundred Years' War was not going very well at that point. People, I suppose, were brought up on the successes of Crecy and Poitiers and so on in the 1340s, great victories over the French. And in the last couple of decades, that just hadn't been happening. The war was sort of a bit more staccato, I suppose, by then, stagnating as well, I think, that nobody was really getting anywhere. And the fact that somebody was taxing you to pay for that seemed really, really unfair.
Yeah, and especially when, you know, 50% of the population are dead, so they don't have to pay. So the ta burden of tax is going on a smaller amount of people who are working
Yeah.
all the hours to get the fields
Yeah.
harvested or sown, who are, you know, and they're not being paid an awful
Yeah.
lot. They're doing the work
Yeah.
of three men, but
Yeah.
only being paid for the work of one man. And then they're expected to give what they have earned to pay for a foreign war, basically. I mean, you'd had Edward the First had faced opposition from his barons who didn't want to fight in Gascony because it wasn't England, and there was no reason, they didn't see a reason for winning back the king's lands. They weren't going to benefit.
Yeah.
And it would be the same with this as well, with the Hundred Years' War. What benefit did they have of putting Richard II on the French throne?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, it did not affect their lives whatsoever, except in the burden of taxation. The Peasants' Revolt, I mean, it is an episode in itself, and I suppose we will have to cover it one day. But what it did do was show Richard in a good light. He mainly in a good light. He was
Yeah.
14 years old, and he rode out and faced the rebels at Smithfield. And he'd already faced them once. I think, was it at Blackheath? He faced them first or something. And then he had another meeting with them at Smithfield, where Wat Tyler apparently became a bit too presumptuous, raising his hand to the king and getting a bit too close, and ended up getting cut down by the Lord Mayor of London. But Richard had shown his personal courage, because he'd faced these thousands of rebels, placed himself at their
Yeah.
head, because it did become a very tense situation and it looked like it was going to be battle, and Richard calmed the situation by placing himself at the head of the rebels and in the way of his own men. They couldn't attack the rebels because the king was in the front of the rebels. So he calmed the situation. You've got this moment where this young man is showing great promise. If he can be the king who can lead the entire country, rebels and, you know, rebels, peasants, barons alike, and appease everybody. It must have been, oh, wow, we've got this great young king who's going to be magnificent.
Yeah, I mean, by all accounts, he was a good-looking lad as well, and he would have looked impressive, even as a teenager. But I think that the darker side of that whole business is that, having agreed to the peasants' demands and so on, he later then reneged on all of that. But also, I think it shaped how he saw his kingship. And I think his bravery, whilst it was undoubtedly brave, very brave, is rooted in his absolute confidence in the fact that he is king and kind of untouchable, kind of above all others, not just the peasants, but the nobility as well. Like, I get the impression that that bravery arose out of his certainty that he was the man, he was the guy in charge, anointed by God, and therefore they needed to listen to him, and he used, admittedly, a bit of charm to get them to listen, perhaps. And when we look later on at what happens, I think you can see the origins of his attitude perhaps defined quite clearly in that episode of the Peasants' Revolt.
And where the common man would see him as the champion, he looks at the common man as a rebel who doesn't actually respect the majesty of kingship.
Yeah.
Because wasn't it Richard II who first was referred to as Your Majesty?
I think so, yes. Or even High Majesty. There was change in the air during Richard II's reign. I think this is something most people probably aren't aware of at all, that he kind of elevated the status of the monarch to something completely different from what it had been in even in Edward III's reign. Edward III, he wasn't exactly one of the lads, but Edward III had been put on the throne by some of the nobles. So he was kind of their king. Yeah. Richard II wasn't the nobles' king at all. He wasn't anybody's king, and I suppose you could admire him for that, but it meant he was out of touch with the very people who kept him, if you like, in power.
Yeah, I wonder if it's also because he wasn't a warlike king. I mean, there were a few campaigns in his kingship, but he didn't have anything like Edward III had Crecy and the Black Prince had Poitiers. He didn't have that bit where he and everybody else faced death at the same time, and it was only because of English grit that they achieved victory. Didn't have that link with the soldier and the common man that his grandfather had and that Henry V would have.
Yeah.
And I think we forget that because we don't have that attitude to war that they had back then, the chivalric attitude, the war is glory.
Yeah, I'm not sure that the king has to be a kind of war leader.
His uncle, John of Gaunt, Henry IV's father, was the leading noble during his minority. There was no regent set up when Richard II came to the throne. The idea originally was that control of the government would be assumed by Parliament, but increasingly and invariably, I would have thought, seeing as John of Gaunt was the eldest surviving son of Edward III, the responsibility fell to him.
Well, apparently, I read that within Parliament particularly, there was a genuine fear that John of Gaunt would usurp the throne at the accession of Richard II, because he was a boy and because John of Gaunt was such a massive figure, political figure in the reign.
Yeah, and he had so much resources behind him with the Duchy of Lancaster.
Yeah.
He was the most powerful man in the kingdom after the king.
Yeah, but he was kind of excluded from the immediate years of Richard's reign. He didn't have a great deal of influence. It was his brother, Thomas, of Duke of Gloucester. I think he was Buckingham at that point, but he was later Duke of Gloucester, who seemed to be the leading advisor. Of course, these are both uncles of Richard II, surviving sons of Edward III. But it seems to me that those first years were rather kind of wayward, and there wasn't really any great control. And Richard, he wasn't an adult, he wasn't able to exert his own control.
Yeah, the government was led by Richard's uncle. But Richard, usually during a minority, you just hear, you know, the king's being at his lessons and, you know, being schooled. But Richard did have a lot of influence and increasing power as he grew into his teens. So he had his favourites, like Robert de Vere, the Earl of Oxford, and Michael de la Pole. And he did go to war with the Scots in 1385, which I was surprised at, because it was like, oh, he would have only been...
Not very effectively, though.
Well, he was about, what was he, 18, 19?
Yeah, he would have been about 18.
Of course, they had to retreat without bringing the Scots to battle. But then the following year, it was him who appointed de Vere to be Duke of Ireland.
Yes, a new title, I think.
Yeah, and regent with full regency powers, and Michael de la Pole as chancellor. And that seems to have been the catalyst for the opposition to arise.
Yeah, but I mean, this is where I think that it did seem unlike any other minority I can think of in the period. Normally, you either have a regent who is basically with some of the other prominent nobles and churchmen, is directing affairs, or you have a council with several important men in it, again, which is directing affairs. In Richard's early years, you don't seem to have either of those.
No.
It's a bit of a muddle, it seems to me. And it allows Richard, as you said, to have his own favourites and to appoint them to ridiculously powerful positions. And I don't know whether it's his fault or not, but without really taking into account other individuals at court who would expect to be important in advising him. And so you end up with opposition, of course, from those people that matter. When we talked about the peasants' revolt, at the end of the day, the peasants did not have the power in that period to effect major political change.
No.
That would come later. The only people with the power to create major political change were the nobility. And it was the nobility, or some of them, who began to act against Richard. I mean, I think it was Parliament, correct me if I'm wrong, who set up in 1386 what they called a controlling council, a council that would bring Richard to heel, if you like, would control what he was doing. And he didn't like that much, and he decided to go on an extensive tour of the country and leave London.
That's what they tried to do with Edward II at one stage as well. So it's something that they had done in the past when a king was wayward.
Yeah.
So it seems to be, you know, that's what we can do. We don't have a great many powers. They did it also with Henry III. Famously, you know, Simon de Montfort,
yes.
That's actually what he was doing.
Yeah.
So it's something that they'd used in the past. It did tend to lead to war and rebellion, so I'm not sure why they thought it'd be any more effective this time.
Yeah, does it stem, I wonder, from the kind of Magna Carta type intervention where a whole load of barons and churchmen say, hang on a minute, we need to do this. Yeah. This is going the wrong way. It's kind of like that, as with Henry III, as you said, and Edward II. There's that kind of thread that runs through, where enough of the important men of the time say, hang on a minute, we need to change course a bit here. We need to influence what's going on.
Yeah, and like you say, that was in Magna Carta. In one of the last clauses of Magna Carta was to set up a council of 25 barons. They were all John's enemies, which didn't help very much to persuade John to agree to it. And Magna Carta was the thing that I think Richard didn't think about in the way he tried to dominate court, because Magna Carta brought the king within the law.
Yeah.
And Richard appears to have set himself up above the law.
Oh, definitely, I think.
And above Parliament.
And so we have the people who were known as the Lords Appellant, who in the late 1380s decided that enough was enough, and they had to, I guess, do two things. They had to control Richard and get rid of his favourites, who were obviously advising him what to do. And the Lords Appellant included, perhaps most prominently, Thomas, Duke of Gloucester, who was a surviving son of Edward III, along with Thomas Beauchamp, the Earl of Warwick, Richard FitzAlan, the Earl of Arundel. Those three, to start with, were the key men in attacking Richard's favourites. Mm. And when I say attacking, I mean attacking, not just complaining about, but actually taking up arms and trying to do bodily harm too.
Yeah, and it has to be noted that this happened at the same moment that John of Gaunt sailed for Spain.
Yeah.
He went to try and win the crown of Castile. He's out of the way. He can't stop them. He's the other main influence in the country. Mm. So Thomas of Gloucester takes his chance and takes effective control. He brings in also Thomas Mowbray, the Earl of Nottingham, and Henry Bolingbroke,
yeah,
the son of John of Gaunt. I mean, these are the most powerful men in the country. Bolingbroke, with his dad in Spain, he's got control of the Duchy of Lancaster.
Yeah.
I think also what doesn't help is in medieval times, English kings didn't have a standing army.
No.
So these barons are the ones Richard would have called on to help fight any insurrection. The problem yeah. was these barons are the insurrection, and yeah. they've all got their own private armies that they can put in strategic places all over the country.
Yeah, I mean, their policy towards his favourites was very aggressive indeed. They executed eight of them.
Yeah,
De Vere managed to escape along with one or two others, but they exiled about 40 from the court.
Mm. And when they're exiled, their lands are forfeit. And guess where those lands go?
Yeah. And that's very important, because it does help us to understand perhaps a little bit why Richard acts as he does later on.
Mm.
But basically, at that point, Richard is forced to go along with all this. So it's a kind of line in the sand, and the Lords Appellant are saying, look, enough is enough. These people have got to go, and we'll guide you. We'll be the ones who will determine what ought to happen.
You see, what got me about this, and I was very surprised about, because I didn't realise it, was that at this point, Richard is still a minor.
Yeah.
He's 19 years old, but still in his minority. He declares himself of age in 1389.
Yeah.
So this has all happened when he's technically still a minor.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's odd, isn't it? Because when you look, particularly in the later Middle Ages, at some of the people there, like, I mean, Henry VI comes of age before that age. And
Edward
IV is fighting battles at the age of 18
yeah.
on his own behalf, you know. So it does seem a bit odd in a way, but I guess the people, the sort of princes and children of kings and so on, there was a variation as to how, at what point they came of age.
Yeah, I mean, Henry III was about 25 when he finally took full powers. For a little while, he didn't want to actually, you know, rule. He was happy being king, but happy with somebody else doing the governing.
Yeah.
Whereas you have Edward III, who had yeah. 3 years where his mum was effective regent of England, but then he decided once he'd got a son of his own, he took the matter into his own hands and took control of the government. And he was only 17 or 18 at the time. So you do wonder why.
Yeah. If you look at it from the point of view of the Lords Appellant and others like them, Richard II's reign was straying from what they were used to in the relationships he had with his leading nobles. And in what was generally going on, it wasn't a very successful reign from the perspective of the barons. And I think I can understand why they said to themselves, well, look, he's listening to the wrong people, basically. Mm-hmm. So let's sort of have a reset. Let's go back to what it should be like, and we'll advise him. And I guess if you're a nobleman wanting to advise the king, you want it to go on for as long as possible. Yeah. So the fact that he happens to be 19, 20, 21, 25 is irrelevant from your point of view. You just want to carry on controlling what he does.
Mm.
But of course, Richard isn't prepared to go along with that for very long.
Which is understandable on Richard's part.
He's
king. You know, they've been telling him for 10 years that he is king. He has the responsibility. It's his decisions. They've been trying to tell him that he has to temper those decisions. But at the end of the day, the book stops with him.
Yeah. But there's then that kind of limbo period where in the early 1390s, where it appears that it's all sort of they've all made up and everything's OK. And Henry Bolingbroke is promoted. He's made Duke of Hereford. Was it Earl of Hereford?
Earl of Hereford.
Earl of Hereford. And Thomas Mowbray, who was the Earl of Nottingham. I think he's made Duke of Norfolk, if I remember rightly.
Yes.
At that point. So some of the Lords Appellant do pretty well out of it, and others as well, not just them. But Richard does shower a lot of titles and so on people at times.
But you're also wondering if, you know, benefiting Mowbray and Bolingbroke is actually driving a wedge between the Lords Appellant.
Yeah.
You know, and it's dividing them, you know, praising some, getting them back on side. It's weakening the actual opposition.
Yeah.
So that eventually Richard feels strong enough to act against them. I don't think he was a stupid man. So he's taking his time and dividing in order to conquer.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think, and during that period of the 1390s, he's really developing a new style of kingship. And he's acquiring soldiers wearing his own livery, which again is very, as we said before, it's previously really only the nobles who have extensive forces. But he's actually building up an army of his own, which is very, very unusual and quite worrying if you're a member of the nobility. He's also, it seems, much influenced by ideas that stressed that all power devolved from the king. And in fact, he said this at some point, that he wasn't subject to Parliament. Parliament had no control over him at all. Well, of course, all of that goes against, as we said earlier, the ideas of Magna Carta and things which followed that the king was within the law and could act within the law. But in Richard's case, he's saying, no, I'm above all of that. The only power above me is God.
Yeah.
And that was a big change for the men in power at the time.
And it's funny, that divine right of kings doesn't actually come into prominence again until the 17th century with Charles I. It's a very innovative idea of kingship.
Well, I read somewhere that he was inspired by the ideas of a 13th century writer called Giles of Rome. Who basically declared that idea or crystallized that idea that all power devolved from the king, and that not only that, but obedience to the king, therefore, was an important part of that whole style of kingship.
Well, it was, but feudalism worked both ways, didn't it? And this was still a feudal society. So, yes, power devolved from the king, passed to the barons, to the knights, to the lowly peasant at the bottom of the ladder. But it also went up, they all had responsibility to the king, but in the oath that they took to the king had a responsibility to them to protect them and to protect their lands.
Yeah, but it didn't say how much influence they had over how he was going to protect them. And that was, it was still consistent with that in Richard's eyes, because in his eyes, he was the man in control. He would look after his subjects, but they needed to give him absolute obedience and not argue with him about things. And I think perhaps we'll come to this later, but it's more to do with his personality than anything else. Personality and mental state, which we can have a look at in a minute. But of course, what happens in 1398 is that Richard gets his revenge on the Lords Appellant. And obviously, as you said earlier, I think he's been biding his time and getting himself in a position where he felt strong enough to take on these very powerful magnates.
Yes.
And boy, does he strike hard when he strikes. Gloucester is imprisoned
and murdered.
I think, what's the phrase that's used? Died whilst confined, or died whilst in police custody. Anyway, he was very likely done away with.
Yeah, he was arrested, shipped off to Calais.
That's right.
And probably, most likely murdered, died in his sleep. Probably under his pillow, laying under his pillow instead of on top of it.
And the two other original Lords Appellant, Richard FitzAlan, Earl of Arundel, he was executed pretty quickly. And Thomas Beauchamp, Earl of Warwick, was originally going to be executed, and then he was sentenced to life imprisonment, and then I think they finally exiled him.
Exiled to the Isle of Man.
That's right, yes.
Yeah, he managed to plead for mercy from Richard, which is quite unusual when you think of the way he treated everybody
But I
else.
mean, these were three heavyweights.
The parliament that this all happened in is called the Merciless Parliament.
That's right.
So it shows what people think of Richard at the time with this parliament. You know, he was merciless, and he really was.
The difference in the way that those three heavyweights were treated, I think, also illustrates a very important part of his personality, which is the inconsistency and the sort of sudden changes of mind, which also gets him into trouble afterwards. But I mean, why should Arundel be executed and Warwick
And
not?
Gloucester murdered. Why was Gloucester murdered? Why wasn't he brought to trial?
Exactly. So it was all very shady and all a bit suspicious, I think, to those of the time. And of course, the two younger Lords Appellant, those who joined later on, Bolingbroke and Mowbray, they remained for a little time in Richard's favour.
Yeah.
But what interested me, and I didn't know this when I did a bit of research into it, was how much treasure and land was confiscated from the people who were punished. Wagon loads of gold and silver objects and so on were carted off to Windsor. Richard took his pick of what he liked, and the rest was melted down. I mean, it's sort of wholesale destruction
Yeah.
of their goods and chattels, as well as redistribution of their lands. And of course, when land is redistributed, somebody always benefits as well as somebody suffering. And Bolingbroke and Mowbray probably did pretty well out of that.
Yes. Now, what we haven't talked about is Anne of Bohemia. A lot of people seem to think that Anne of Bohemia, his first wife, she died in 1394. Just before Richard acted against the Lords Appellant. And from what I've been reading, a lot of people seem to think that Anne was a tempering influence on Richard. And whether or not it was in the grief of losing Anne, I mean, she died of the plague in 1394, and he raised the Palace of Sheen to the ground because it was where she died. So he was very affected by her death, grieved quite considerably. But you do wonder how much influence she had had on him to say, no, Richard, don't, you know, you don't want to do that. Calm down, bide your
Yeah,
time.
it's difficult to say now, isn't it? But of course, the other aspect of that, and something which proves critically important later, is he didn't have any children.
No.
And that so the marriage in that sense was a failure because there was no heir.
Yes.
And he married again later on, didn't he?
Yeah, Isabella of Valois.
But she was a child, wasn't she?
Yeah, he doesn't seem to have been in a hurry to have an heir either, because he married Isabella in 1396 as part of the treaty with the French,
Yes.
which was a pretty impressive treaty, arranged for a 28-year peace,
Yeah.
sealed with the marriage of Richard to the daughter of the French king. Unfortunately, she was only 8 years old.
Yeah.
So he wasn't expecting to have an heir anytime soon, which doesn't exactly promise stability for England.
No, I think people would have thought that as well, wouldn't
Yeah.
they? The prominent people would have thought, hang on a minute, this is stupid. There's no future there. And given Richard's problems with his barons, I think that would have been, they would have regarded that as a mistake, certainly, at the
Yeah.
very least.
Well, they'd have been thinking, right, she can't get pregnant for another 8 years, 7 or 8 years. He's already approaching 30. I think that was the year he turned 30. He's 30, can't have a child for another 7 or 8 years. So that child won't reach adulthood for 28 years from that moment, which means there will be a minority. If he ever does have an heir, you're going to be looking at a minority again.
And we've talked about this occasionally before with William Rufus and others, that for some kings, like Henry I, it's the most important thing on the planet that he has an heir.
Yeah.
And for some kings, like Richard II, it doesn't seem to have been that important. And yet, given his style of kingship, I find that quite hard to understand.
Yeah, me too.
You'd think he'd want to preserve it all.
Yeah, with William Rufus, you sort of could see it because he did have an older brother and a younger brother. So there
Yeah.
was somebody to take, even though he didn't like either of them. Frequently at war with both of them. It wasn't
Yeah.
as big a succession crisis because there were other adult males there to who could take on the reins.
Yeah.
With Henry the First, once his son had died, there was no obvious adult male
No.
to advance as his successor.
Yeah.
And with Richard, he didn't have a younger brother who he could have, be thinking, well, it doesn't matter if I die before I have a child, I've got my younger brother to take over. There was the grandsons of Lionel of Antwerp.
Yeah, I mean the heir presumptive at the time was Edmund Mortimer, who was Earl of March, as you say, descended from Edward III's second son, Lionel, Duke of Clarence. And this is where the whole discussion about the causes of the Wars of the Roses comes in, because in terms of straight seniority of lineage, Edmund Mortimer was the sort of the heir presumptive.
Yeah, and he was a grown man, and Richard must have thought felt secure in the fact that this grown man who was actually a
Yeah.
soldier as well, because he was fighting in
Yeah.
Ireland at that moment,
Yeah.
he would have been a capable ruler if Richard had died.
And not someone who was at odds with Richard particularly either.
No.
He was kind of on side, but maybe Richard also thought, well, God has put me here to do this job, and God will ensure that I am successful.
Yeah.
So maybe he left that in God's hands, the heir and so on, and thought, well, whatever is will be, sort of thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, very, very strange in a way. As we know from later history, there was no shortage of people with a claim to the throne.
No, that's the problem when you have Edward III having so many sons.
Yeah, there were probably about 30 people with a fairly good claim to the throne.
The difference, of course, is that Henry Bolingbroke, supposedly an inferior claim to the throne, but he was the son of the Duke of Lancaster,
Yeah.
who had, like I said earlier, was probably the most powerful man in the kingdom after the king. And he was technically on Richard's side at the Merciless Parliament.
Yes.
He'd reconciled re with Richard for a time in 1396, and it all seemed to be going well. But then something happened in 1398, didn't it?
This whole episode is very strange. And I mean, it's where the Shakespeare's play starts, really, is a dispute that arises between Henry Bolingbroke and his sort of erstwhile ally, Thomas Mowbray, both of whom are a part of Richard's government at that point. But they fall out, and it's because, if I remember rightly, Henry tells Richard something that Thomas has confided in him. And it becomes then an issue of whether Henry has been telling the truth, or whether Mowbray has revealed something he shouldn't have revealed, so to speak. And it becomes a question of honor almost between the two men. And it all gets very, very angry, and they want to fight a duel, basically. And at first, Richard says, okay, then you can settle it by force of arms. But then at the last minute, he says, oh, hang on a minute. No, let's not do that. You're both exiled.
Yeah. And I wonder how last minute it was. I couldn't actually find out. I have this image of the stands being full of crowns, both of them in the lists with their lancers couched, ready to go, and then Richard going, hang on a minute.
Well, that's the Shakespeare image, isn't it? That's the picture Shakespeare paints at the very beginning of Richard II. And
Yeah.
therefore, I've got that in my head as well, because I stage manage Richard II in the Abbey Ruins in Reading. All I know
Yeah.
about Richard II has in the past has been from that play. But Richard did make some sudden changes of mind, and I just think maybe this was one of them, but I'm not sure why. Why didn't he just let them settle it? And one suggestion is that he thought Henry Bolingbroke would win, and it would enhance Henry's position in the realm.
Yeah.
So whether that's true, I don't know, but that's an idea.
Yeah, that makes sense. It'd make Henry look a bigger hero. And Richard didn't need Henry to be any bigger a hero than he already was.
Yeah, so by exiling them both, I mean, again, interestingly, totally inconsistent. Henry's exiled for 10 years, Mowbray for life. What's that about? You know, does that doesn't make any sense at all?
Unless John of Gaunt went up to Richard and said, "Can you, is my son, he's going to inherit the duchy one day. Can
Yes.
you, give him the chance to come back?"
Yeah, because John of Gaunt was, he was about to die. I mean, he probably didn't know exactly that he was about to die, but he was quite old. And, you know, his days were clearly numbered. So maybe, yeah, maybe that's why he made it 10 years. But I mean, 10 years is still a heck of a long time. The exile of Henry Bolingbroke is not totally the end of the world. Things
No.
change. He might be recalled. He may be able to reinstall himself. The end of the world comes when John of Gaunt dies and Richard takes the Duchy of Lancaster back into the crown, which
Yes.
means that Henry's whole inheritance, which is a pretty, as we've said, a pretty powerful inheritance, is lost completely. And if you're Henry, you can say to yourself, well, I'll try and position myself in exile to get back in the king's good books, to get back in the country. But the removal of his inheritance is a whole different
I mean, the
thing.
inheritance wasn't just, it was called the Duchy of Lancaster, but it was the earldoms of Lancaster, Leicester, Derby, Lincoln, I think,
Hereford, presumably, as well.
and Hereford. Yeah, it was an impressive amount of lands and titles.
It was, I guess it was sort of vaguely comparable to Richard Earl of Warwick in the 1450s, where, you know, a huge amount of land and estates. And as we've said before, you know, it's not just about soil, it's about people on that land, his tenants, his retainers. But the power he has is related to the number of estates he has, the income he has. So the resources are enormous.
So Richard confiscates them all and extends Henry's exile to life.
Yeah.
He's basically backing Henry into a corner.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And he can either fight or just accept it. And I'm not sure why Richard thought Henry would just accept it.
Well, do you not think, again, this is his personality, that because he believed that he was inspired by God, that God would ensure that he made the right decisions and so on, and that he was kind of untouchable? I think there's that feeling that he made the decisions, and because he made them, they were the right decisions, and there wouldn't be any consequences that he couldn't deal with. But then he went to Ireland.
Well, I've confiscated my cousin's lands. I've told him he's not allowed back in England. So what can I do now? Oh, yeah, there's trouble in Ireland because at that point, his cousin Mortimer, who just happened to be his heir as well, is killed in Ireland.
Yeah.
So he decides he's got to go and sort Ireland out.
He takes a big army to Ireland as well.
He takes a really big army.
About 8,000 men.
Leaves his uncle Edmund, Duke of York, in charge of England.
Another uncle.
Yet another uncle who has never actually been given a great deal of responsibility.
He sort of kept his head down, hasn't he?
He wasn't the most capable of men. When you look at his history, it's like he'd never been given command of armies and
No.
things, and yet suddenly he's left in charge of England and makes a bit of a hash of it. 4th of July, Richard's campaigning in Ireland, and Henry lands at Ravenspur in what is now East Yorkshire, used to be Humberside. But he lands with 300 men, claiming he just wanted to get his inheritance. Now, interestingly, when Richard went to Ireland, he took most of his nobles with him, leaving Edmund, Duke of York, in charge of England, but also leaving Henry Percy and Ralph Neville,
Yeah.
the Earls of Northumberland and Westmorland,
Yeah.
respectively, in the north. And funnily enough, when Henry lands, within no time at all, Neville and Percy are with Henry. So there's this thought that Henry's actually been communicating with England for quite a while and finding out who his friends are and who's likely to help him and who's not likely to help him.
In Shakespeare's play, it's certainly presented as a kind of plot in which Ralph Neville and Henry Percy are deeply involved. But I don't know what the evidence is for much prior communication at all. People who've heard us talk about the Wars of the Roses will know that there was massive rivalry between the Neville and Percy family in the 15th century. In the 14th century, it wasn't quite the same. They had shared responsibilities, as they do later on, but there wasn't, I don't think, such a long-standing hatred between them and rivalry.
No, and there were a couple of marriages between them as well, I think.
Yes. So we have Ralph Neville and Henry Percy being allies of Henry Bolingbroke as he moves south from Ravenspur. And what are their motivations? Well, I guess their motivation is to increase their power and authority, because that is generally the motivation of nobles.
Exactly. I mean, it's a gamble, isn't it? Because Henry's only got 300 men and they don't know how the rest of the country are going to take it. But if they've gambled right and Henry is the one who wins, then he's going to owe them.
Yes. Yeah, that doesn't exactly end that well, but that's another story.
Well,
But the guy who's left in charge, as you said earlier, is Edmund, Duke of York, Edmund of Langley. And so he could have stood in Henry's way if he chose to, but he didn't.
I mean, he may have tried to raise an army and discovered that he couldn't, because Richard had taken most of them to Ireland.
Yeah.
And Henry, as he moved south, was attracting more and more supporters.
Yeah.
Edmund, like I said, he wasn't considered the most gifted of Edward III's children, even before this point.
No. But do we need to ask ourselves the question why Henry Bolingbroke did get more support as he moved south? What was the attraction, or what was the reason why? And he clearly did get fairly substantial support.
Yes.
Because he was pretty confident when he finally actually met Richard that he was going to be in charge.
And as far as we know, when he first landed, he swore that he was coming to claim his inheritance. And he was still swearing that as he travelled down south and gathered his army. He was still saying, I've come to claim my inheritance.
But he clearly wasn't.
No.
These things always look more clear cut in hindsight, don't they? I mean, at the time, your average, let's say your average knight, or even sort of one of the lesser nobles who's sitting there in his path, is thinking, well, why would I oppose this guy if he is just coming to claim his inheritance? If he's not just coming to claim his inheritance, if he's trying to take the throne, also, why would I oppose this guy? Because it's just me and my few retainers. There's nobody calling me to arms. Like, as you said, Edmund, Duke of York, isn't apparently calling people to arms to defend the kingdom against Henry. So maybe at the time, it's pretty muddled for most people. They're not entirely sure what they would be opposing. Are they just opposing Henry Bolingbroke trying to get the Duchy of Lancaster? Or would they be opposing Henry trying to become king? It's all very, very vague at the time, I suspect.
Yeah, and it's like, I mean, it's in Henry's interest as well not to say that he's here to claim the throne.
Yeah.
Overthrowing a king was not something everybody wanted to do.
No, not at all, no. The thing is, though, do you think Henry intended all along to take the crown from the moment he arrived, or even before he arrived, or do you think he changed his mind?
Well, that's the question, isn't it? It's like the Richard III question. When did he decide he was going to be king? When did Henry IV decide he was going to be king? Even until Richard was deposed, he was still telling Parliament that he was there for his inheritance, because he wasn't Richard II's heir.
No, exactly. No, he wasn't the person. He wasn't, even after Edmund Mortimer died, he wasn't the heir.
Edmund Mortimer had two sons who were Richard's heirs.
Yeah.
So he couldn't claim that he was coming to replace Richard, because technically he couldn't actually guarantee that he would be the one to replace Richard.
Yeah.
It was in his favour because he was a grown man and the two boys were, 8 and 6 years old or something like that. They were children.
Yeah. But my own personal view, which may or may not be the case, is that I think he intended to take the throne all along, simply because he could not see any way that he would get the Duchy of Lancaster back and keep it and have any sort of relationship with the king
and live.
If Richard was still the king. I think he'd already decided that. If someone exiles you for life and takes your entire inheritance, that's the end. You go for the jugular. And although he said he was only going for the Duchy of Lancaster, I think he intended all along. And he must have known Richard was in Ireland. Something like that would have been known.
Yeah, he must have known because the timing was perfect. Richard was away in Ireland. And then what happens is Richard gets news about the invasion. God knows why he does it, but he heads back to England, landing in Wales, but he splits his army. He sends 4,000 to land in North Wales and 4,000 to land in South Wales. You've got this massive army that probably that would have been able to put on a good show against Henry, but you split it up.
Do you not think he was just so confident that nothing could remove him, could shake him, that he thought, it doesn't really matter, you know, I'll just turn up. I'll just turn up and it'll be fine.
Yeah, but what happens when he gets to Wales is the news is dire. Everybody's following Henry. His army's fading away with desertions every day. He manages to meet the other half of his army, which is led by Salisbury. The problem is Salisbury's heard that Richard's dead and disbanded his army.
Rumour. Well, this is the thing, of course, at the time that we often forget is communication was not very good and not very swift. So sometimes rumours became truth and then became rumours again.
So you wonder at what point Richard suddenly realised, actually, maybe God isn't on my side.
Yeah, I mean, that's more of a conundrum, I think. Once Henry had decided that he had to take the throne, all sorts of issues then arose, because if he just deposed the king, then somebody else was, as we've said, the heir, not him. So he had to justify why he should be given the throne.
Yes.
And he had to get Richard to abdicate. Because if Richard was just deposed and was still alive, then he could come back again. And there could be a plot to get him back, put him on the throne again, and he would still be king, because he hadn't abdicated his authority. If you get him to abdicate, then he has made that, in theory, made that decision. So there's no going back on that. So there was a lot of discussion in London around September of 1399, where they were trying, I think, basically everyone was trying to find a form of words or a method by which Henry could become king and Richard could disappear into the distance without being killed. And that plan, that idea, that came about at the end of September, beginning of October, when Richard abdicated. What did Richard think about that?
Yeah, well, one report was that he abdicated cheerfully.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, of course he did. Yeah. I mean, he didn't have any children, so there was no abdicate or your children have a bad life. There wasn't a lot of leverage that Henry IV had to persuade Richard to abdicate beyond promising to let him live.
Yeah, and clearly he was given the assurance that he would be allowed to live. In these sort of circumstances, it's not just Richard that needs that. I think it's those who are taking part in the whole process need to justify to themselves that they have ensured that this particular injured party is not going to be killed.
Yes.
But having said all that, clearly he was an unpopular king. Otherwise, it's quite plain people would have fought for him.
Yeah, he was an unpopular king, but he was still king.
Yeah.
Richard believed he was anointed by God, and so did everybody else.
But when you look at Henry VI, for example, Henry VI was arguably a worse king than Richard II, but certainly he was deposed. He was not king for 10 years or so. He was then made king again, and so on and so forth. But people still wanted to fight for him, despite his shortcomings.
Yeah.
So I asked myself, well, why did people not want to fight for Richard II?
After the deposition, there was some support for Richard. So I wonder if it was that the people who would support him were surrounded. You know, when you look at the Duchy of Lancaster and where those lands were, maybe the ones who would have supported Richard weren't in a position to actually raise troops and lead the support.
One of the areas Richard had tried to establish support was Cheshire. And Cheshire is pretty adjacent to the Duchy of Lancaster estates. So it may be, as you say, that they felt they weren't in a strong enough position.
They were fragmented and spread about and not able to form a coherent opposition. Richard was in Henry's hands. He's first imprisoned in the Tower, but then sent to Pontefract Castle, which is a Duchy of Lancaster stronghold.
But the thing is, Richard had dealt so badly with the nobles, he had alienated large numbers of them. It wasn't just Warwick and Arundel and Gloucester who had been punished. Many others had lands confiscated as well. And that filters through.
It was also the fear
of
confiscation. If he can confiscate the lands of some of the leading nobles in the country, he can do it to anyone. And the threat of confiscation of lands, of disinheritance, was a really big thing for any family.
Yeah.
And Richard had hit those families to the core. Just threatening to disinherit them is enough to go, well, why would we fight for you then if you won't protect our land?
Yeah, and heavy fines as well were imposed on a number of families. So my feeling, and it's just a gut feeling, I don't know, is that there weren't that many of the nobility who were willing to lead the charge for Richard II. That there weren't enough of them. There were some, we know that. We know that the Earl of Salisbury led a plot to free Richard. But of course, that rather backfired because it persuaded Henry Bolingbroke, Henry IV, at that time, that Richard couldn't be left alive.
Yeah, and that plot, it was a rather drastic one. It was known as the Epiphany Rising, and it was set for 6th of January, 1400. And the idea was that they would murder Henry IV and all his sons. Yeah, they were planning to wipe out the entire family. And it was Salisbury, Thomas Holland, John Holland, Richard's brother, Thomas Despenser, who was married to Constance of York. Now, Constance of York is one of those consummate plotters who gets involved in everything. And her brother, Edward of Norwich, who would be Duke of York.
Well, they were the children of Edmund of Langley, weren't they?
They were the children of Edmund of Langley. Yeah. And either Constance or Edward, most likely Edward, was the one who told Henry IV of the plot, because Edward's the only one out of all the men involved in the plot who didn't get executed.
Yeah.
So it seems likely that he's the one who told of the plot. And so Henry survives this plot. Nobody gets killed except the conspirators. But it's like, this is what's going to keep happening if you keep Richard alive.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So Richard was probably done away with. There's no real solid evidence as to how and exactly when, though. I've seen a date given of the 14th of February.
I think he was definitely dead by the 14th of February.
Yeah, his body was brought to Westminster, wasn't it?
King's Langley. He was buried King's in Langley. King's Langley.
Yeah, that's right. And it was later moved to Westminster by Henry V.
Yeah, the theory is he was starved to death because there's no marks on the body.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it was either he was starved. I think there was one report that he died of melancholy.
Yes.
Because much like Richard Henry VI did, you know, you just.
Yeah.
But it seems more likely that they just stopped feeding him.
Do you think melancholy was a medieval euphemism?
They said that he refused to eat. So I don't know where that came from, but I think it's more likely that they refused to feed him.
Yeah, I mean, people find this hard to understand sometimes, but this is a period when if you want to ensure that someone is definitely not going to be a threat, the best way was to kill them. I mean, it's a fact.
Yes.
You know, it happens throughout the period. It happens into the Tudor period and also into the Stuart period and so on.
Although, interestingly, it doesn't stop people claiming to be the dead person.
No.
Because there was Richard II imposter who was entertained at the court of the king in Scotland.
Yeah, he turned up in Scotland.
So, it didn't actually.
But in this case, so Richard's body had been exhibited and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
And it was so soon after he'd been in the public eye that I can't imagine, you know, bishops and earls looking at this body and thinking, oh, yeah, that's not Richard at all. Okay, well, let's tackle the difficult topic of Richard's personality, because that's been a subject of controversy ever since he died, really.
He was not a very martial king, Richard. He wanted literacy, culture flourished in his reign. He invented the handkerchief.
Did he? I'm
Yes.
so pleased he did something useful.
Apparently, he invented the handkerchief. And as we've said already, he was the one, he was the first king to be addressed as Majesty.
Well, that's more a reflection of his need to be admired and worshipped, really, isn't it?
Yes.
His status was important, and his looks were important to him as well.
When you look at it on the strength of his personality, it's not a surprise he was dethroned.
No, I mean, what's interesting is that in the 19th and 20th, well, early 20th century, historians were talking about him being mad. I mean, obviously, mad is a term thrown around in previous centuries. It's not exactly a technical term. But the reason they said that, I think one of them was Bishop Stubbs writing in the 19th century. And the reason they said he was mad was that he was acting unlike how previous kings had acted. So it was an aberration, if you like, and therefore he must be mad. In the 20th century, some historians have said, well, he was a schizophrenic. And that explains why sometimes he did these unusual things. It was like two people were in charge of the country. Again, that's not necessarily been accepted as a real thing. But there is this idea that what he did was so out of step with Edward III's reign, and I guess Henry IV and Henry V and so on, it must have been because he wasn't mentally stable or had a problem.
Yeah, he was certainly an anomaly.
And I think the fact that he doesn't seem terribly bothered about having an heir is also a bit of an anomaly, which adds to that. So, yeah, I mean, he's supposed to have been a deeply pious man. And again, we have this, I think what we talked to David Gilman recently, and he talked about this dichotomy between the medieval man who was deeply pious and at the same time capable of brutal acts.
Yes.
Very brutal acts. And there is that kind of conflict which existed in people of the time, I think. It was a brutal time, yet they believed, their faith told them, that doing pious things, religious acts, would save their soul, as it were.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, we don't really have any evidence one way or the other, but I do think that he felt that pleasing God was more important than pleasing any of his subjects. So he was certainly not a pragmatist. I think we can eliminate that possibility. Because a pragmatist like Edward III would have said, yeah, okay, this is the situation I'm in. I rely on these nobles to be in power. I need to keep at least some of them on side.
Yeah, even Edward I made concessions to his nobles when he needed their help.
Yeah.
It's just Richard seems to have this idea of, I'm the king, I'm the one in power, it's my what I say goes, and that's that.
Yeah.
There's no discussion.
No.
And you actually have to get on with your nobles because they're the ones who administer your justice, who raise your armies. So you've got to, it's compromise all the way. You might be king, but you've still got to compromise.
The word high-handed is frequently used to describe the way he acts. But what I recalled from when we talked about Edward Black Prince a while ago, and it seemed to me that he had learnt nothing from his father in that respect. It's difficult, isn't it, to get into the head of, you know, any of these medieval people, really. But, you know, we say things sometimes with confidence, but we don't really know what was in their head. And in Richard's case, I think we know less than most others. So Henry takes over the throne with the help, important help, of the Percys. Not just Henry Percy, but Thomas Percy is his brother, who was the Earl of Worcester. And also, as you said, Ralph Neville, Earl of Westmoreland. The way I like to describe Henry's reign is it's kind of a reign where he's always looking over his shoulder, because the way he gets the throne is obviously suspect. He basically seized the throne, and he was helped by a faction of the nobility. Now, that faction, as we said earlier, are going to want rewarding. And it's not that long before they fall out with Henry Bolingbroke, Henry IV. And the Percys fall out big time with him.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure. I know the justification for it, which is to do with the Percys defeating the Scots heavily.
On Muldoon Hill.
Yeah, they crush the Scots. They take a lot of prisoners, and they expect to be able to ransom these prisoners, which will obviously be a lucrative source of income. But Henry IV asks for those prisoners to be given to him. And this allegedly, this is what Shakespeare says, but it's also, as I understand it, the justification that the Percys gave for their opposition to Henry IV. And the leading light of that opposition is the man who goes down in history as Henry Hotspur, who is the son of the Earl of Northumberland. So that then is a major rebellion, isn't it?
You get 1403 and the Battle of Shrewsbury.
Yeah.
Henry Hotspur's killed in the battle.
Yeah. What happens at Shrewsbury is Hotspur races to battle almost, and his father, Northumberland, doesn't get there. So Hotspur is fighting with a percentage only of his potential force. And it's still a close-run thing. It's a very close-run thing. And you wonder then if he'd waited for Northumberland. I think his uncle, Thomas of Worcester, was there. But Northumberland wasn't there presumably a sizable Percy retinue. And the other thing, of course, is that their erstwhile ally, Ralph Neville, Earl of Westmorland, has decided to stick with Henry IV. So maybe there's an origin there, part of the origin of the Neville-Percy split, you know, that at Shrewsbury, the Nevilles are on Henry IV's side.
And maybe the Nevilles decide to go on Henry IV's side because they just think, actually, we go with Henry and we get, you know, pick up the spoils of war.
Yeah, because at the time, the Nevilles were of inferior power to the Percys. Yeah. The Percys were the dominant family in the north by a long way. But Shrewsbury changes, well, Henry IV's reign changes that balance.
And of course, Ralph Neville is Henry IV's brother-in-law.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There are further rebellions. There are further revolts.
Yeah, it carries on till 1408, Bramham Moor, where the Percys are defeated and the Earl of Northumberland is executed.
That's why I say looking over his shoulder, because he's been king for 8 years or 9 years, and he's been facing all these challenges. He only lives another 4 years or so, and most of that time he's ill. By the end, I mean, he's not really in control at all. He's so ill.
No, he has problems with his eldest son, Henry of Monmouth, who forms rebellions of his own certain times until he grows up a bit. He was badly wounded at Shrewsbury. I mean, that must have been a moment for Henry to see the eldest son and heir within a whisker of losing his own life.
Yeah, yeah. Henry IV had done what Richard II hadn't. He had lots of sons. He had several sons. So the future was kind of assured one way or the other.
Yes.
So, yeah, I mean, he established a dynasty in the end.
He did. He established the House of Lancaster.
But it wasn't easy. Well, of course, the other issue for Henry IV was that there was another Lancastrian line of descent from John of Gaunt's third wife, whose name escapes me.
Catherine Swynford.
Catherine Swynford, yeah. And that's the whole Beaufort line of descent.
We've managed to get hold of Nathan Amin, who is going to come on in a few weeks' time and hopefully tell us a bit more about that.
About the Beauforts, yeah, which will be very interesting. Okay, so what do we conclude about Richard and Henry? Richard had redeeming qualities, but essentially his mindset, his attitude towards the kingship crystallized into what he thought was important. And at times he would go off into flights of fancy about that, the theoretical kingship that he held, and forget about the pragmatic day-to-day dealings with his actual subjects.
Yes, and he was inconsistent.
Yeah.
In his dealings with his subjects, which didn't help.
No.
I mean, technically that would keep his subjects on their toes, making sure they behave properly, but at the same time, they never knew where they stood.
Nobody likes uncertainty, really, do they? Yeah, I think that was a big problem. But having said all of that, I think he would have died a natural death on the throne had he not taken the Duchy of Lancaster into his own hands. That proved to be a catalyst. Now, maybe Henry Bolingbroke would have invaded at some point anyway, but it certainly forced the issue, as you said earlier. It forced Henry Bolingbroke into a corner, and it meant he either had to abandon his inheritance completely or try and do something about it.
It didn't give Henry a way back.
No, no. Okay, so that's it, folks. We've dissected Richard II.
We hope we've given you something to think about. It wasn't a period I was overly familiar with, so it's been very interesting looking into it and seeing the reasons behind the usurpation. And it was a usurpation.
Yeah, got away with it.
He got away with it. So thank you very much for joining us today. We hope we've given you some insight into Richard II and Henry IV. Do join us next time when we will be interviewing Danielle Burton and talking about her new book, Anthony Woodville, Sophistica and Schemer. Woodville's always a fascinating character, so I'm looking forward to seeing what she thinks of him. I've been Sharon Bennett-Connolly.
And I'm Derek Burks. Thanks for listening. And do subscribe to avoid missing a podcast. If you enjoyed it, perhaps give it a like. We'd love to have a rating or a review from you. Join us next time.